help churches work together to serve their neighbors.
That, to me, I just get really excited about.
There is a sense of the church to come together to respond to those needs.
Well, welcome to the City Gospel Movement's podcast, where our goal is to help celebrate and accelerate gospel movements around the world by interviewing leaders and hearing their stories.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the City Gospel Movement podcast. Today, we have the incredible privilege of being with Jason Jans from Cross Purpose. Welcome, Jason.
It is good to be here.
Thanks so much for being with us. So, Cross Purpose, your tagline is live different together. And what you do is help people get out of poverty and stay out of poverty. And we can't wait to hear from you today. I was so intrigued when we spoke with you a while back about what you're doing there in Denver, Colorado, and it just felt like for sure everyone needs to hear about just the stories that are happening and the people, the lives that are being changed through Cross Purpose. So would you start, Jason, by just telling us about what Cross Purpose is and what you guys are doing there in Denver?
Yeah, Cross Purpose is a nonprofit focused in the inner city of Denver, Colorado, and our mission is to abolish, you say, economic, spiritual, and relational poverty through career and community development. So we basically take people who live in financial poverty and over a course of 6 months build family around them as well as a career opportunity for them to expand their wages and live self-sufficient lives.
So Jason, I think it was one of the most intriguing things about our conversation earlier was why you started this. Can you share just kind of what was motivating you to want to do this?
Yeah, I grew up in the Midwest and my dad's business collapsed when I was a kid. And so from the earliest memories I have until we made a change of life and moved to Denver when I was 11, my childhood was basically a childhood of poverty. And so I remember living in poverty and thinking, man, who can help us get out of this problem that we're in? And just not finding, you know, many people that would help, but often, you know, close relationships with people would, you know, let us sleep in their basement for a while after our house got foreclosed on and we moved to a new city. So, you know, then I got involved in, you know, vocational ministry as a pastor and became part of a church. And it was a church that helped our family get back on its feet back when we moved to Denver in 1985. And then over 20 years of being in that congregation, I just felt like I wanted to be part of a church that would more aggressively pursue the community and really move beyond just Christian conversion as a goal of outreach in the neighborhood and looking at a more holistic gospel that didn't just love the soul, but love the body as well, and said, we want to walk with these people. So that's kind of what spurred me to move downtown with my family, you know, 10 years ago. But then we were pretty much kind of addicted to, I call it drive-by Christianity type of charity, where we just, you know, feed people, give them some clothes or a backpack or Christmas gifts. But nothing really changes the game around poverty. And so after working with about 3,000 people in poverty, I started saying, we have to have a different solution here than what we're currently doing as a church.
And break that down for us, Jason. I know that you realize that in order for people to get out of poverty, they had to have a certain dollar per hour job. How did you get to that place of kind of being able to recognize what people really needed?
You know, somebody said to me, Jason, 99% of nonprofits ask the question, how do you help somebody in poverty? We want to ask a different question. How do we help people get out of poverty? Well, then I said, how do you define poverty? Well, the federal government has defined it. And for a single mom with one kid, that's about $16,000 a year. For a family of four, it's about $22,000. So if someone's going to actually get out of poverty, they have to make more money than that. The other myth is that if someone gets a job, they get out of poverty. Well, there's a difference between jobs and there's really then good jobs or careers that will actually help people move towards self-sufficiency. $10 an hour jobs is not going to get people out of poverty by and large. And so I started realizing we need a far heftier solution if we're going to move people down the economic kind of runway toward a different life. And I think we just have to admit to ourselves that we're not changing the game by having a Thanksgiving dinner for the poor. Actually, we're just another form of dependency. And when I see you know, a lot of churches hate government programs and dependencies and handouts. And I find that the church is far less rigorous on a whole in how they distribute charity, because the government will make somebody in poverty fill out 5 job applications for the welfare check. The church just gives you the food and prays over you, and, you know, there's no accountability. And so I just was going, there's a disconnect here between what we believe about the world and how we're acting out our good works in the neighborhood.
So how did you break it down? Take us inside the workings of Cross Purpose and how it works.
Yeah, so I'll tell you a little bit what didn't work. So we started an ex-offender program where we helped 500 guys a year coming out of prison. We gave them hygiene kits and bus tokens and backpacks and some counseling. But nobody was actually getting good, solid jobs and able to get their own place and get on their own 2 feet and reunite with their families, all that kind of thing. So I just like, we were taking a little league bat to the major league. We've got to sit there and change our approach. And so we developed over the course of a couple of years, a model where we basically, I call it like, you know, good Samaritan, all encompassing kind of love, where we actually say, we want to help this person, but we want to help them in the biblical model of justice, where you actually help them until the need is completely met. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing holistic care, but I'm on the hook, not just to start the work, but to also finish it, to where they actually have money in their pocket. And it's amazing to me how many poverty programs out there don't address the money issue when that's the core issue, right?
Right, right.
With most churches and Christian charities, it takes a lot of money to do that well, because, you know, we bring people in and we work on mindset change. So they're in the seats all day long, 6 weeks, and we work on mindset change and soft skill development. Then they pick one of 32 different career pathways that they want to go get trained in, so they can actually get a job that's $15 an hour or more. And then we also are on the hook for getting them that job before they can actually graduate. So that's really building the financial capital. Then we build in social capital, where they become friends with each other as they go through the program. They also, we bring in community volunteers called allies who walk with them and have dinner with them every single week for 6 months. And those are called our family gatherings. And that's how we build the social capital. That helps keep people out of poverty. It's not what you know, it's who you know. And then the third piece is a spiritual capital, where, you know, we build into their lives spiritually through counseling. We offer the Alpha course that they can go through and try to get them involved in a faith community if they're willing, and see that part of their life be built out as well.
And so what has been some of the results of the program that you've been able to create?
Well, we have about 100 graduates so far. Tonight we'll graduate another 25. I think this year we'll add another total of 80 graduates. So we're kind of in that hockey stick of growth, where we're scaling as an organization to help more people. We'll work with 225 neighbors next year going through the program. So I think the results, obviously, to me, is life transformation, right? Because if you look at Maslow's hierarchy of need, right, that bottom part of the pyramid is safety and survival. When people get their basic needs met of food, clothing, and shelter, now they can actually think about what they were created to be and their calling in life. And so I call it the oxygen. They get oxygen into their life. Now they can breathe, and then they can start saying, hey, what do I want to do and have an impact on the world? And my theory is those who've been through the deepest struggle will also be able to help those the best who are going through deep struggles. So I think we're working with an army of people who I say are the future of our urban communities by developing them as leaders. So, you know, tonight I'll hear 25 stories and I'll be a weepy, crying mess as I hear about all these changes that are made in people's lives. I mean, one woman, kid got diagnosed with diabetes, you know, 2 weeks before she started class, but now she's completed her training and she's got her own job. Another woman, her husband died halfway through the program. She had 4 kids and he had 4 kids from a previous marriage. So now she's a single mom with 8 kids, and she actually changed her career path. She's into an insurance pathway and she's finishing up that and finishing her other career pathway training as well, while being a single mom. And I'm in awe of them.
I am too, Jason. I mean, it's been, I think I've probably told your story to 100 people that I've talked to since we spoke, because I just think it's so fascinating, especially for all of us who've been in the faith community and have filled a lot of backpacks, right? And the mind shift of, are we really helping a systemic problem here? And so what is it for you when you see these people who go through this program and you really know this works?
Probably their testimonies, I would say. I mean, I'm watching 100 people a year walk through this transformation process. Honestly, when we talk about spiritual, social, and financial capital and building those tiers, they actually talk the most about the social capital. That's what's actually most impactful to them, because we're living in a segregated society. It's segregating faster than it ever has since the 60s around race and class. And also, both poverty and wealth, I have learned, tend to isolate people. And so as our Western society has moved down the tracks, we're becoming more and more alone. Just Google like the loneliness problem, and you'll see now that Cigna Healthcare is saying they're tying loneliness to the opioid epidemic, right? So that means social capital is where the American communities are frayed, and we don't know how to build relationships across race, class, and political lines. And so when you actually bring people together, I actually believe in the inherent imago Dei in people, that we are created for community. And when you throw economics onto the table and say, let's change the economic situation, almost everybody's interested in that question in their communities. And they all have preconceived ideas on how to do that. But we provide this greenhouse of relationship, and that thing just bubbles out, and people start helping people. And, you know, I can't employ enough staff to meet the needs, but when you just engage the common neighbor in deep relationship with a neighbor in need, you see phenomenal things happen. They're helping each other move, they're fixing each other's cars. And this is, to me, what is shalom. It's reweaving the fabric of a frayed society. And I think that's really powerful.
Yeah, no, it's really beautiful. And I think it is part of the answer. How are people coming to you? How do they know about this program? Are you working with state agencies? How are people getting introduced to what you're doing?
Yeah, I'll set the frame by saying that when I talk about poverty, most people think of homeless people. I want to make sure people know what we're talking about here, that it is only 2% of the poverty population in the country that is homeless.
Wow.
98% is housed. Now, in the average American city, a vast majority of the nonprofits are slated to help that 2%. In our city, it's 52 nonprofits contributing a total of public and private dollars of $60,000 per homeless person per year.
Oh, right? My goodness.
Yeah. So when I talk about the poor, I'm talking about the single mom with two kids is not going to sit out on a street corner and fly a sign and try to raise 50 bucks for that day. There's a huge population. I don't think any American lives further than 15 minutes away from people living in poverty in that situation of less than 16K a year. So I think it's really important to say, here's who we're after. I work with the 52 nonprofit agencies and say, hey, we're the next step. Once they find housing, we'll then help them get to self-sufficiency. So I call that like tier two intervention, mm-hmm. as opposed to tier one. So I think we have 85 total partners that work in some form of human service, Christian nonprofits, government agencies, that refer people to us, because we're really the Tesla of poverty programs, because we actually do the entire Good Samaritan thing. We walk with them all the way through. We pay 100% of the costs. Every person gets a $500 relief fund if the brakes go out on their car. And we give them a living stipend of $400 a month while they're going through the program. So nobody else in town does that. And I say that with, I would say, good Christian pride, in that I think Christians ought to be the experts and the most loving people in communities, because we serve this Christ who loved the poor and had this all-encompassing desire to see them lead flourishing lives.
Jason, I know that you have a mentor, businessman, who shared with you some pretty powerful information, kind of a crash course in nonprofit work. Would you share that story with us?
Yes. I mean, we moved into the neighborhood 10 years ago. We were flat broke. We were starting a non-denominational church. So we had to put our kids into the local neighborhood school. I showed up the first day. The media was there. The superintendent was there. And I was like, why are they here? You know, there's 170 Denver public schools. And the reporter told me it's because this was the worst school in the whole state of Colorado. The only school ever closed down by the State Board of Education. The only place where KIPP Charter has ever failed in the country. And I was like, oh no, what have we done?
Have a good day, kids.
Yeah. I run over to my wife and I said, you know, your parents already struggled with us taking kids to public school instead of private school. We're also now in the worst school in the entire state. I said, so I'll go get two jobs. We probably need to do something else, or we better get really involved. And she was like, let's get really involved. And I was like, no. That changed our life. So she volunteered in the classroom. I joined the PTA. The third PTA meeting I was at, a man, a multi-millionaire walked in, unbeknownst to me, and he said, I want to adopt this school and help turn it around. And he ended up giving our school $1 million. And we started working together on making that school a better place. But then he called me and said, hey, Jason, you know, I want you to help me work on some other projects. I give away about $1 million a year. Not a man who proclaimed to be a believer in God. He said he believed in Christian values. He just didn't believe in the church and didn't believe the gospel. And so it was really this kind of unusual partnership. We think it's unusual, but in the Bible, you see it all the time. And so I started working for him, and here's a 70-year-old businessman who flipped 50 businesses around and has given to charity his whole life and really just took me under his wing as a mentor and almost like a father, I think, to just show me what really good development work with the poor looks like and what really good business looks like. You know, I have a theology master's. I mean, I learned how to read a financial statement. I didn't learn how to do outcomes and measurables and data and how to test our theories and all those kind of things. And he just taught me that. And it was 7 years of just a wonderful learning experience for me. He passed away 2 years ago, but his family administers his trust and they still support the work we do quite faithfully.
Oh, that's a great story. I love that. You know, sometimes the things that scare us the most, I have a friend who says, just beyond your greatest fear is your biggest blessing.
Yeah.
And so I love that, you know, through that, just diving into something that felt scary, out came this incredible ministry that you guys are doing and a way to serve your community. Jason, what do you say? I'm so curious about if you had a room full of pastors who were doing very much what is just kind of a normal and very loving and gracious thing for communities of filling backpacks and taking care of Thanksgiving dinners or clothes closets or things like that. How would you challenge them and what would you say to a group of pastors to maybe think a little differently about how they're going about things?
I think most pastors say, yeah, we should help the poor in our community. So let's do a backpack drive and a Christmas gift giveaway. And let's do a single mom's car fix up, you know, all those things that we've all done. I think those things are good. I just think they ought to think more deeply about it. There's a great book called When Helping Hurts that talks about the American poverty problem does not demand a relief solution. It demands a development solution. So I would try to get them to think about what development looks like as opposed to relief. And then secondly, I would try to say, I think you ought to work at community engagement, especially with the marginalized and the poor, as a means of spiritual discipleship. Most Christians don't read their Bibles and pray. And I think it's because they don't think they have to, because nothing in their life really demands faith, especially in a culture of wealth. And so, and I say wealth, meaning that anybody who lives above the poverty level, because Jesus only had two economic classes, poor and rich. So if you live a middle to upper class life, you're a rich person.
Right.
Bible verses about the rich are written for you. So, and I would say with the rich, we've so insulated our lives as rich people to eliminate all risk that there's no fear anymore. There's no like, and so I just go to church and I hear sermons and songs in a sanctuary on a Sunday. And that's what I view church to be. But our people aren't being discipled. The pastors all know it. They know they're not seeing spiritual formation the way they would like to. And I say, throw them out into the community. I say, create chaos. Your job as a pastor is to create chaos in their lives to where they're actually then dropping to their knees and praying and saying, God, I don't know what to do here. How do I love my neighbor really well? And so I would try to convince them, honestly, that ministry in the community is Christian discipleship. And then you'll have the context in which you're preaching and teaching is going to connect on a much deeper level because your people are out there on the edge of faith trying to do something for the kingdom.
Yeah. I always say, you know, this walk with our Lord should be absolutely thrilling. Yeah. But the only way to get it to be thrilling is if I go out and take some risk, right?
Yeah, we're just fear. We've insured ourselves away from fear.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. A friend of mine, Jeff Lilly, was the former director of the Seattle Gospel Mission. And he used to say, you know, resources aren't our problem, similar to what you're saying about just kind of the wealth of the American church. He said, we have a relationship problem. There's a story that you had told about one of these gatherings, your social dinners once a week, about somebody who had just been released from prison but was sitting amongst people and nobody knew each other and who they were. Can you kind of share a little bit about just what that experience is like for people on both sides, people who are going through the program and people who are coming alongside them?
Yeah, so we try to get rid of the old mentorship model, which comes across kind of paternalistic to the marginalized. We try to talk about mutual mentorship, and that everybody that walks into the program, whether they're someone trying to get out of poverty or someone as a volunteer that we call an ally trying to help someone out of poverty. We tell everybody, when you walk in the door, whether you're rich or poor, you have to identify your own poverty. We all have poverty in our lives. Some might be economic, some might be spiritual, some might be relational, and some might be emotional, right? So identify your own poverty. This creates an equal ground upon which we can interact. Then what we do is we introduce them to one another and we form small groups. In those small groups, you'll have about 7 people trying to exit poverty and about 3 allies who are walking alongside them. So group about 10 people. And then we kind of do a little speed dating and they choose their little ally trio that they want to walk with them. Then we go on a 2-day retreat. It's like camp for adults. It's silly games and fun songs. But then we teach on how to develop a friendship in the 7 different levels of intimacy. And then the second day of the retreat, they just sit in a room and tell each other their life stories for about 20 to 30 minutes apiece, which I find hardly anybody will listen to you tell your life story anymore. And they come out of that, and there's a bond that has been formed there. And you find that the rich have just as many problems as the poor. When they start opening up to each other, they become a mutual support group for one another. So in one group, I've got a Silicon Valley guy who, you know, he's been on the cover of Money Magazine and sold his business, and now he's the chief investment officer of this Silicon Valley firm. And he shows up in shorts and a t-shirt and a ball cap, and he's sitting next to a guy who spent 8 years in Angola, America's worst prison, and they're friends, right? And they're hanging out together. And I can give you 100 of those kind of stories. And what you see now is this family developing that I think smells like the kingdom. And I think the church is just a sneeze away from being able to do this, because one thing we can do well as the church, I think, is relationship building, small groups, and we get into people's hearts pretty quickly. And nobody else is really, I'm just saying nobody else, but very few organizations are doing that in culture today.
Right, right. One of the my favorite books lately is Tattoos on the Heart by Gregory Boyle down in California. And he's got a church right between the 2 worst housing projects in LA. And he said, nothing changed for me until I realized I had just as much to learn from them as they had to learn from me. And it had to flip for him to be able to really be in that environment and create long-lasting relationships. And it sounds very much like what you guys are doing.
An activist said, if you've come here to save me, you're wasting your time. But if your liberation is tied up in my liberation, we can work together. I love
it. Yep. Well, and I think it goes back to, what did you say about the typical way that we kind of come in and save the day, or we serve in a way that isn't relational, that doesn't create a mutual relationship?
Well, you have a paternalistic charity model.
That's what you said. Yeah.
I'm whole, you're broken, and I'm here to fix your brokenness. You will eventually come where the people who are coming to serve despise the poor, and the poor end up despising the people serving. And because there's no relationship built, there's no understanding, what people have come to realize is them doing the handout every single week is actually going against their own values of how you really help somebody. And so people just churn through that and end up walking away from substantive work for the poor, because they don't see a model that works. And so I think we just we're just filling that niche there, saying, hey, no, there's a way to do this and do this really well. It's hard. I mean, it's really hard work, but it is extremely nourishing.
Yeah. So with that, you know, what's in the future for Cross Purpose, and how do you see your organization growing? You said you're kind of on this hockey stick where you probably have more people wanting to come into the program than you have space. What are some of the next steps for you guys?
Yeah, I like what Truett Cathy from Chick-fil-A said. He said, let's get better before we get bigger. So I think, you know, the next 18 months for us is we're calling it the Blue Ribbon Program. We want to become absolutely first class with the experience of everybody involved in the program. And we are getting some communities that have asked us to come. So we just had a mega church in the suburbs say, we want to do this. Will you teach us how? So we launch a chapter there October 22nd. And we'll start with 15 families there in the richest county west of Appalachia, okay?
Wow.
9th richest county in the United States. We'll be doing a poverty program because there's 11,000 people in poverty in their county. And so, you know, that's exciting to me. I wrote down my life goals last year as I tapped my own heart. It was to spark a neighbor-loving movement within the Church of Jesus Christ. And I think this is just one tool. There's a lot of tools you can use to do that. But this is my favorite one.
Well, it's clearly affected you in a way that you're kind of in now. Like you can't get out of this, right?
Yeah, I wear black every day because of the Johnny Cash song, Man in Black. But unlike Johnny Cash, there's a few days a year where I wear a different colored shirt because, you know, the black shirt, if you listen to his song, symbolizes the poor and the beaten down living on the hopeless hurting side of town. But on Easter and Christmas, I wear a different color because that's the hope in the darkness. And then tonight I'll wear a white shirt at graduation because 25 people have new lives.
Oh, I wish I could be there. It'd be so fantastic. So Jason, if people want to get involved in their community, what are the first steps that they should take?
So I think you got to look at the Good Samaritan parable. And it says, hey, who's my neighbor? And Jesus tells this story. And I actually think neighbor is not the person who lives next door to you. Neighbor is somebody who you come in contact with who is suffering. And if you just sit there and ask that question, who do I come in contact with my life who's experiencing suffering, and you go and endeavor to meet a need, that script right there will take you to some places. So you know, we just had a shooting yesterday outside my kid's school, 2 blocks from our house, right? The whole community is rattled. It was a junior higher shooting another junior higher in broad daylight at 2 o'clock. The parents are all up in arms because we didn't get the text messages in time. Their kids were on lockdown. Nobody knew if their kid was safe, all that kind of thing. But I think we got to ask the question right now, who is suffering? Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you who's suffering is the kid who was shot. The staff and faculty mm-hmm. are suffering. They're going to get tons of criticism for not responding and giving the information quickly. You have kids inside that school who know the shooter and the victim, right? They're suffering. The shooter is just got arrested this morning. I guarantee you he and his family right now are suffering. There's enough work right there for any citizen to walk in and just start loving on people, and God will guide your heart. So I just say, you don't need an organization. You don't need a nonprofit. You don't even need your pastor's permission. Just go and love. And you will find this full life just right in front of your nose.
Amen, Jason. Amen. Couldn't have said it any better. Well, Jason, if people want to get a hold of you, what's the best way to get in contact with Cross Purpose?
Yeah, just email me, jasonjans@crosspurpose.org.
And the website is crosspurpose.org. Jason, so great to talk to you. It's so motivating. I love, love, love what you guys are doing down there. And thanks so much for taking the time to share with all of us.
Thank you so much.